everybody. For those of you who don't know me, and I don't think there are going to be very many of you, my name's Louise Gulliver, and I am chair of the Faculty of Law here in Cambridge. And it is my enormous pleasure to welcome you today to the second of three Hamlin lectures given by Dame Sarah Worthington. For us in the faculty, it is a great honour and a great pleasure to welcome Sarah back to give this lecture. Sarah needs very little introduction to most of you, I'm sure, but just a few things about her. She held the Downing Chair at Cambridge for 11 years until 2022. And before that, she was at the LSE for 14 years, during which time she was a pro-director, which I think is a bit like being a pro-vice-chancellor, is that right? Yes, for 5 years. So she's now back connected with the LSE, where she is, among other things, chair of the LSE Press. Now, I took this from the website, so I assume it's correct. Sarah's research is primarily focused on controversial areas relating either to personal property rights or to abuse of power in commercial, not-for-profit, and corporate contexts. To my knowledge, she's written extremely extensively about equity, personal property, and company law. For many years, she's been one of the editors of Gower's Principles of Modern Company Law, for example, and she's written a Clarendon book on equity and even has contributed to a book on personal property for a bit. Anyway, I want to tell you actually a bit about the Hamlin lectures, because you may not have come across them before. They are always delivered in threes. There are always three Hamlin lectures every year. And it's a very prestigious lecture series, which started in 1949 with lectures by Lord Denning entitled Freedom Under the Law. Now, the lectures were instigated by a bequest in the will of Miss Emma Hamlin, who was a non-lawyer. She wasn't a lawyer at all. And she was from Torquay. She lived most of her life in Torquay. And for those of you who don't know, it's in the southwest of England, on the coast. And she died in 1941. Miss Hamlin was an independent-minded person, and she drafted her own will, and she refused to let her solicitors change the draft. It appears that the bequest was made in memory of her father, who was a solicitor, practiced for many years in the West Country, mainly in Torquay. Now, for those of you who are interested in trusts and in wills, you might be interested in the wording of the bequest, partly because of its sentiments and partly because it wasn't a model of entire clarity and required a ruling from the High Court to decide exactly what it meant. But I'll read you the bequest. So it reads as follows. I bequeath the residue of my estate to my executors as trustees, upon trust to apply the income of the trust fund in the furtherance by lectures or otherwise, among the common people of this country, of the knowledge of the comparative jurisprudence and the ethnology of the chief European countries, including our own, and the circumstances of the growth of such jurisprudence, to the intent that the common people of our country may realize the privileges which in law and custom they enjoy in comparison with other European peoples. It says, and realizing and appreciating such privileges may recognize the responsibilities and obligations attaching to them. So that was the trust. After some amount of litigation going to the High Court, it was held to be a charitable trust and therefore could be for the benefit of a wide number of people, the public generally, the common people of this country, which was interpreted to mean the UK, in other words, England, Wales, Scotland, and Northern Ireland. So since their inception, the Hamlin Lectures have been an opportunity for our most eminent legal scholars and judges to reflect on the fundamentals of our law. And they've given them to generations of students and members of the public in universities around the UK. They're then published to reach an even wider audience. And it is a feature of the lectures that they're usually each held in a different place. Hope I've got that right. That's the ones I've come across anyway. So Sarah started her Hamlin journey last week in Edinburgh, and finishes next week in London at the LSE. Sarah's quest is to investigate what we protect as property, that is, what is, can be, and should be, and should not be, the object of property law and property rights. And once something falls into that legal category, what are and should be the consequences? Now, this is obviously an ever-present question throughout the history of law, but this particular question, what should be the object of property law, is an issue of great topicality at the moment, given the recent advances in technology that have led to value being attributed to information and data in many and varied forms. It is difficult to imagine that Miss Emma Hamlin could have foreseen that her generous bequest would lead to us, all of us, the common people of this country, hearing a lecture 84 years after her death on the application or not of property law to such things as crypto assets, AI-generated art, data such as browsing histories, and so on. Yet the vision of this far-sighted lady, who was not a lawyer, have led these common people being able to be guided through such cutting-edge subjects from one of the deepest thinkers on personal property of our time. So I hope Miss Hamlin would feel that we, the common people, will appreciate the privileges of the application of the law of property to particular assets, and we'll also appreciate the responsibilities that the application of property law entails. So this lecture, as I say, is one of three, but it is also self-contained, and Sarah has very kindly agreed to answer some questions at the end if there is time. So thank you very much, Sarah, for choosing Cambridge as the venue for this lecture, and we greatly look forward to what you have to say. Thank you.
I'm not sure what Miss Hamlin would think of what I'm doing over these three lectures, but it is a great honour and an enormous privilege to give the Hamlin lectures, and I must say, quite nerve-wracking given the calibre of my predecessors. Here in Cambridge, that's added to by Louise's very warm introduction. It will have raised expectations beyond what I can deliver. And I'm especially sorry because what was advertised on the website in advance of me writing any of the lectures, you know how this happens, is not exactly what I'm doing. So I think a lot of the students here are to hear about crypto. That's next week. but Louise will probably be disappointed as well. Thank you to the Hamlin trustees for asking me to do this, and to the Cambridge faculty and staff here, especially to Helen Waring and Daniel Bates, who have been wonderful to work with in making this show look effortless. I wanted to give one of these lectures in Cambridge because I had two very happy periods here, formative periods, in fact. One as a PhD student, supervised by Len Seely, working on, of course, property. He told me then that it would keep me happily occupied for my entire career. And as Louise said, the second was an 11-year period as a member of the faculty. That was actually a crucial time in my intellectual development, and my thanks go to very many people who contributed to that. But I wanted to say to the students here, it was the students as much as the faculty who made that so. Cambridge has wonderful students, and they, together with the amazing faculty and a run of interesting visitors, endless interesting visitors, were very valuable. But finally, and importantly, I had fun in those two periods. I had a lot of fun. And so it's a real treat to be back lecturing to you tonight. But let's begin. As Louise said, these three lectures form a single argument about property, though most of you will only hear this one. That means I need to give you some sense of the shape of the whole and the part that this lecture plays in it. That's not easy, and especially not easy when you only get the middle one. Some of you might want me to explain things that I said in Edinburgh, and some of you may hope I'll get to things like crypto, that must wait for the LSE. But this is Cambridge. We'll manage. I chose property as my Hamlin subject because property touches everyone. It's where the law's protection feels most robust. We all own property. Even children grasp that idea. Property brings rights that are good against the world, rights to use, to profit from, and to control access to a thing. That sense of security is powerful, and that source of power and protection, that sense of power and protection, lies behind current calls for property status to be extended to personal data, body parts, crypto assets, privacy, image rights. The list goes on and on. But one of the lessons from my first lecture was that simply labeling something as property tells us almost nothing about the detail of the consequences which follow. The property label is not a substitute or a proxy for all the hard policy work that must still be done by the courts or by Parliament. And further, in doing that hard work, the red thread that's running through my three lectures is that we as lawyers have focused too much on the rights of ownership and too little on the responsibilities or the liabilities or the obligations that might accompany those rights. And in that sense, these lectures mark a departure from my usual doctrinal focus, which has in a sense been an unrelenting sort of rule of law focus, concentrating on the incidence of legal and equitable interests and the scope and scale of the protection, with my sole goal being, as I kept endlessly repeating, was to argue for coherence and consistency in our property rules so that we could be confident that like cases were treated alike. That is important. But here in these lectures, what I want to do is stand back and ask a still broader question. What's the entire framework of property for, and what might be missing from it? We already accept that ownership is limited. I can't drive my car as I please. I can't demolish a listed building simply because it's mine. And moreover, notice that those limits don't exist to protect me, but to protect other individuals and sometimes just the general common good. And yet our legal architecture still centres on the owner's entitlements, with far less attention given to restraints and responsibilities that ownership brings. So the central idea in these lectures is this: property law exists to protect valuable resources for the benefit of society. That protection necessarily involves both rights and responsibilities. If we think of property in only two dimensions, the rights of and the obligations owed to an owner, we miss the third dimension, the public purpose that justifies having private ownership at all, and the corresponding responsibilities and obligations that may flow from the owner out to the wider world. So my hope is that at the end of these lectures, we can begin to imagine a more complex, true, but a more complete three-dimensional conception of property. One that balances entitlement with responsibility and sees ownership not simply as a bundle of rights, but also a form of stewardship and responsibility. Although I really need a different word from stewardship. I explained this last week and we'll say more next week, but it immediately triggers a sense of fiduciary responsibility, and I am so far from that. I don't want the fiduciary baggage. But that's where I'm going. So tonight what I want to do is set up the middle plank in that broad argument, and to do that I want to look at the questions, what do we own and what can we own? Those questions matter in themselves, of course, but they matter much more right now as the pressure grows for all manner of new forms of valuable assets to be recognised and protected as property. Now, in unpacking those questions, my goal is simply to make three remarkably simple points. And I want to make them through examples. I want to make them through stories, partly because stories are more memorable, but also because that mirrors the common law. The stories came before the recognized legal architecture. Nevertheless, I'm used to teaching this sort of stuff. If I set out my three key messages first, you'll at least know what to look for in the stories. And I hope that by the end of the lecture, you'll see how each story contributes to the larger argument that I'm building. So my three messages are these. First, in deciding what we do own, deciding what we do own is complex, even where the subject matter is uncontroversially property which can be owned privately. Secondly, deciding what could be owned privately as property is equally difficult, even where the thing is clearly valuable. And thirdly, not all valuable things can or should be privately owned. Sometimes other legal tools provide better protection, perhaps protection of the person rather than protection of their property, or perhaps there should simply be control of use of the asset while the asset remains unowned. In short, what we should remember in all the current clamoring for assets to be recognized as property is that the line between property and not property doesn't mark the division between protected and not protected. So, to the stories. What do we own? And the typical means of acquisition. As I said earlier, everyone here owns property. Most of you bought it, you were given it, you made it yourself, and that description includes both tangibles, you know, your books, your laptop, your artwork, and also intangibles, your bank account or the copyright in your novel, In My Dreams. And I don't want to dwell on those familiar categories of acquisition tonight. They certainly have their paradoxes. So a lot of you here will have studied Re London Wine and Re Gold Corp, where purchasers failed to secure title to the goods they thought were safely theirs. But they're not tonight's concern. But I do want to note just a few ownership puzzles that arise even in this simplest context of property, where you clearly own property at the start of the story. The problems typically surface when a third party intrudes and the parties haven't agreed what should follow. So, for example, you all appreciate that if you lose your tangible property, your title doesn't vanish. Although if you and your property are not reunited, then the finder's keeper's rules apply. And even if you do find your property, your claim in conversion doesn't entitle you in England to recover the asset. Your rights might also lapse under statutory limitation rules unless a thief was involved. And that same fragility operates in commerce. So, under a remarkably common retention of title agreement, for example, your continuing ownership depends on you being able to identify your goods in the purchaser's hands. If that can't be done, then your carefully negotiated property rights may evaporate, however innocent you are in the failure of the identification. But sometimes the problem is a quite different one. It's you can identify your property, you know exactly where it is, but it's become irretrievably united with property belonging to someone else. And in those circumstances, the law has a difficult choice. The combined asset could be shared between the contributors, or it could be owned by one party, or it could be owned by no one. And the common law's approach is wonderfully pragmatic. It ensures that, in general, tangible property remains in private ownership, that assets are only co-owned if severance is possible, so the two strangers can go their own ways. But the two strangers are not bound together by co-ownership of an asset that's physically difficult to divide. Now, those cases will certainly feature in the book. They're all fun. But cases on mixtures, accessions, new creations, and they show the wonderful variety ranging between property lost completely when my hay is fed to your horse, nothing left, or shared if oil and wheat are of different grades are commingled, or owned by only one party if wood chips and resin are turned into chipboard. Roman law divided those problems neatly between mixtures, differentiating between wet and dry ones, accessions, and specificatio, or creation of a new species. But the common law's adaptations are far less tidy. And in any event, the accurate categorization has become blurred. So I gave you wood chips and resin mixed together as a new product. But is it really a new product, or is it just, you know, you stick the two things in a big container, stir it up, it's a mixture. And who owns what depends vitally on how you categorize that set of facts. So I want to offer you one vivid example. I want to call it the Picasso problem. If I own a blank canvas and you scribble on it, my reaction might be to sue you for trespass to goods or sue you in conversion for damaging my canvas. You can see where I'm going, can't you? But suppose Picasso scribbles on my canvas. Now my priorities change, and the question has more teeth. Do I still own what was a perfectly ordinary canvas, but is now a work of art worth millions? And you might think this is a bit like someone coming polishing your shoes or painting your front door. But in these circumstances, with a Picasso masterpiece in the sight lines, the law is likely to decide that a completely new product with a new function has been created. And then the orthodox common law rule is that the creator owns the new product. So that means Picasso owns the painting, and my clean canvas has been destroyed in the transformation and doesn't exist any longer. Indeed, that would be true if Picasso stole my canvas and then painted on it. But if you change the facts just slightly, it can make all the difference to the outcome. So if Picasso had merely stitched a few eye-catching artistic threads to my coat, then a court would likely decide that my coat's identity and function survived. It would be a mere accession, not the creation of a new product, and the coat would remain mine. So you can see, I hope, how the borderline between those categories can easily become quite fraught, and yet the consequences quite dramatic. A similar analysis applies when Banksy paints on a wall. When Banksy painted the art buff on a wall in Folkestone, the canny tenant of that property immediately saw the financial possibilities and cut the mural from the wall, allegedly in pursuit of his repairing covenant, and sent it abroad for resale. Litigation, of course, ensued between the tenant and his landlord, and the High Court confirmed that Banksy's paint became part of the wall. It was a fixture. It's a kind of secondary problem, isn't it? And the fixtures belonged to the landlord. True, once severed, the mural panel became a chattel, but title still lay with the landlord, and nothing could be read into the tenancy agreement to suggest to the contrary. And the tenant was ordered to deliver up the mural. This is a bit of a segue, but just notice that that case was just between the landlord and the tenant. That case didn't say anything about Banksy's rights as an artist or anything about the public entitlement to continuing display of the artwork or anything about the possible obligation on landlords to maintain these gifts of public art. Although I suppose the fate of the recent Banksy on the walls of the Royal Courts of Justice suggests there's no such obligation to maintain. So this Picasso problem, dramatic, doesn't sound at all commercial, does it? But the ownership problems that it reveals are not just academic. The answers are anything but, because on insolvency, those sorts of answers decide which assets fall into the insolvent's estate. On divorce, what's available for division? In commerce, who owns the transformed goods? And of course, in human terms, do I get the Picasso? I don't want to sum up the lessons I want to take from Picasso just yet, but I want you to note that all of that discussion is about tangibles, not intangibles. I'm going to say something about intangibles later on, but very briefly. But first of all, I want to look at one other method of obtaining property, and that's by capture of unowned property. It's long been possible to become an owner of property simply by taking it. And I don't mean by stealing it, even though Proudhon provocatively said that property is theft, but by taking what belongs to no one. And the classic examples are wild animals or fish in the sea. Many species are now protected by statute, but the underlying common law rule still stands. The first person to take possession acquires ownership of the wild animal. But that ownership is unusually fragile. It endures only whilst possession continues. If the animal escapes and returns to its natural liberty, ownership is lost, at least if the owner loses sight of the animal and the right to pursue it. So you might assume, and I think I had assumed, that all these questions belong to a vanished world of, you know, gamekeepers and fishermen on the high seas. But there was a 2020 Court of Appeal insolvency case, this is why I bumped into it, in Borick Development Solutions and Clearwater Fisheries, that put this on the front pages, I suppose, this century. The claimant, BDS, operated a commercial fishery, attracting anglers who wanted to catch fish for sport and then throw them back into the ponds. These fish were valuable. They'd mostly been purchased by BDS, and they were used to stock 9 enclosed lakes from which these fish could not escape. BDS went into receivership, and the land was sold to the defendant. The fish remained in the lakes, and the contract of sale said nothing about the fish. BDS claimed continuing ownership in the fish, I suppose much as you might say you still continue to own the family dog when you sell your house. And it sued the purchaser in conversion when CWS began operating the fishery. The trial judge agreed with BDS. The Court of Appeal did not. The Court of Appeal said, as a matter of law, all fish are ferae naturae. They're wild animals, regardless of how long or how closely they've been controlled. So any proprietary right of BDS in the fish depended on continuing possession. Once BDS lost possession of the land, and therefore the fish, its ownership was simply gone. The lesson is striking because even in the 21st century, the ancient law of capture still governs who owns the fish in the pond. And the same for other wild animals. That might seem quite dramatic, but it's not just wild animals. The common law rules are much the same in relation to the increasingly crucial resource of water. In English law, no one owns the water flowing in a natural stream, although the riparian landowners, the people on the banks of the river, do have entitlements to the flow and to reasonable capture of the water and use, recognizing that all the other riparian owners share that entitlement. The modern statutory rules, especially the Water Resources Act, now overlay those common law rules with a licensing regime for abstraction and detailed rules to ensure water quality and control of pollution and flood defenses and all the things you hear on the radio every time it rains, it seems. But the Act didn't nationalise water. It didn't do anything about the ownership of water. It just asserted collective control over its use. And so we still have the position where water that's lawfully collected, including from rivers, and held in a defined receptacle, a tank, a pond, a reservoir, is capable of being owned as private property. But just like the wild animals, if it escapes and returns to the stream, it reverts to being unowned. and then percolating groundwater, so water that's moving underground but not in a stream, isn't the subject of that common law riparian rights rule, and a landowner can intercept it unless constrained by contract or statute. And as the House of Lords confirmed over 100 years ago, an owner could even do that maliciously, although now the statutory regulations erode that freedom. But the lesson I want you to take from these cases is to notice that the common law is reluctant to turn every valuable natural resource into privately owned property with rights enforceable against the world. Even with something as simple and as physical as water, the question of whether there's property and who it belongs to and how depends acutely on the legal architecture we decide to build around it. The common law and statutory injections in this regime illustrate a recurring pattern that I'm trying to trace across these lectures, that property is not a fixed entitlement category. It's more like a policy instrument, a way of deciding who can control valuable resources and on what terms. And the law of water shows that the state's answer to overuse and scarcity wasn't to redefine ownership, not to nationalize, but to redefine permission. So that's one lesson I want you to take from these stories. But there are some others. Let me have a look at those. You might be wondering why I've spent quite so much time on these stories of tangible things, paintings on canvas and on walls, embroidered coats, wild fish, water. I've done so because those examples expose the deep structure of property law. They show us what must be true about a thing before the law can recognize it as property at all, and what choices the law may then make about the rights and obligations that follow. So they're simple examples, but the message they give out is really quite powerful, I think. Everything that we've considered so far, the painting, the fish, the water in the stream, exists independently of the law. Even if we lived in a lawless society, there would still be houses and coats and animals and rivers. The law doesn't create these things. It classifies and regulates them. It decides whether they can be privately owned, and if so, whether they should be privately owned, and how securely, and for how long, and with what limits. It determines when ownership is lost, by mixture, by manufacture, by escape, and when it can be qualified or restricted in the public interest. All that's really hard policy work, and is no doubt going to be the hardest part of this journey I'm going on. But before any of that begins, there must be something that's capable of being owned. The asset must exist as a distinct, separable thing, something that's not me, that can be identified, controlled, and enjoyed by me to the exclusion of others. So it must have, this is an ugly word, excludability, or as it's increasingly described, it must be rivalrous, also a pretty ugly word, I think. But the sense is that my enjoyment must diminish if yours begins. And that's a minimum condition for private ownership of property. That's the issue, one of the issues that seems to be a key problem in debates about whether cryptocurrencies can be property. But as I said, that's for next week. But in taking this condition further, last week in Edinburgh, I drew on Tony Honoré's classic list of 11 incidents of ownership to come up with, I suppose, my own idiosyncratic essential three. And the first of those, the right to exclusive use of an enjoyment, is the essential core of property. But even that is never an absolute right. It's exclusive and expansive only to the extent that the law permits. And then my idiosyncratic second and third incidents were the right to transfer and the possible imposition of obligations and liabilities of ownership. That's in Honoré's 11, and yet really rarely mentioned. And they're the places where the real policy work comes into play. But all three incidents provide levers which allow the law to calibrate the individual advantages of private ownership against the controls that are merited to protect the public good, which justifies such private ownership. So that means the tangible examples we've examined tonight are not an amusing detour. They are part of a map of how property law works when an asset exists in the world even before the law touches it. Now, all that matters because in the next set of examples, I want to turn from what we do own to what we can own, concentrating on information and body parts, both of which the law has already struggled with. So what can we own? I start with information as property, and the example is property in a spectacle. If property demands the possibility of control and exclusion, then can something as elusive as information ever truly be mine or property? On the other hand, we live in an information age. Information's been described as the new oil. It's not my expression, but it's a common one. And it's supposed to indicate by an analogy the possibilities and the limitations, but I would suggest it also perhaps indicates the dangers. The idea that if information is the new oil, then shouldn't those who produce information have property rights in it? Yet English law has long resisted that conclusion, holding the line that information may be valuable, but it's not property. So that position is affirmed in Borden and Phipps and Douglas and Hallow, indicating that information is protected only through contract or obligations of confidence or statutory IP rights, but not through common law property rights. But let's take a story. And the Locus Classicus is an Australian High Court case, had to get one in, now almost 90 years old. It's Victoria Park Racing and Recreation Grounds against Taylor. Where does that case take us? It concerns property in a spectacle and is probably familiar to most of you here. But just in case, the plaintiff, Victoria Park Racing, owned a racecourse in Sydney, and the defendant built a platform on the next door land so that he could see the entire racecourse and hear everything that was going on. He arranged for the race results to be broadcast live to a Sydney audience, and this stimulated an illicit off-course betting industry in Sydney and enabled the punters to place their bets and enjoy the race from the comfort of the local pub rather than paying to go into the racecourse. This in turn reduced the crowds at the racecourse and damaged the plaintiff's business. So the plaintiff sought an injunction to restrain the broadcasting, alleging it amounted to a nuisance, an unusual use of the adjoining land, and an interference with the plaintiff's proprietary right in the spectacle conducted on his land. And obviously it's the last of those that concern us. Plainly, and this is evident that the judges thought this too, the defendants had exploited a competitive commercial opportunity in morally dubious circumstances in order to profit from the market amongst horse racing enthusiasts. Yet a 3-2 majority of the Australian High Court held that no legal wrong had been committed in doing that. On the property claim, the court held that the defendants had not taken anything that could be described as the plaintiff's property. Chief Justice Latham said that a spectacle cannot be owned in any ordinary sense of that word. English law doesn't prevent others observing what they can, nor indeed describing what they see, as long as they commit no other wrongs in doing so. And as Kevin Gray, he's the only footnote I'm mentioning in all these lectures probably, but he wrote a wonderfully titled journal article in the Cambridge Law Journal called Property in Thin Air. And he said that this case teaches us that a resource can't be classified as property unless it's excludable. So really it means unless it's feasible to exercise regulatory control over the access of strangers to its benefits. And he used an image of a lighthouse to explain his point. Somebody may have property in the lighthouse, but nobody can have property in the light. Once the light shines, it benefits all within its reach. It's a non-excludable resource, and non-excludable resources remain in the commons. So that's the deep lesson of Victoria Park racing. It remains one of the important property decisions of the 20th century. But contrast that with what happened in America. In International News Service and Associated Press, a 1918 US Supreme Court recognized as a quasi-property right, and probably all had quasi criticized in various arenas, but a quasi-property right in time-sensitive news. And that this was a context where International News Service had copied Associated Press's war reports and sold them in competition with Associated Press. And the court condemned this as unfair competition, and it injuncted INS from using AP's material until its commercial value had passed. And if you're wondering if this is a better approach than the English approach, the two dissenting judges in the US were Holmes and Brandeis. But even the US court did not say that the information was property. Rather, it said that between competitors, there existed a relational interest, a quasi-property, to protect investment and prevent free riding. So the rhetoric of property dignified what really was at bottom a policy choice to protect commercial effort. And Dixon, Mr. Justice Dixon, explained that in Victoria Park Racing. He said what the US case had done was effectively protect an individual's right to profit from their labor, not their legal property. And they protected that right quite aggressively, whereas English law has refused to follow that path. Our statutory rules regulating competition are much, much narrower, and our treatment of information has specific targeted doctrines to regulate misuse of information without invoking ownership. So if we take the Australian case and the American case and the illustrations, we have a coherent pattern in England that for something to be property, it must be capable of identification, control, and exclusion, must exist separately from the person claiming it, and others must be able, at least in principle, to be kept out. And where that's impossible, the law turns elsewhere. Information can still be protected, but by rules that regulate conduct and relationships, confidentiality, contract, data protection regulation, insider trading regulation, copyright, not by granting common law ownership. Those other protections depend on how the information was obtained and used, not on what it is. That reflects, I think, a deep instinct that property shouldn't be diluted into a metaphor for all valuable interests. But Kevin Gray pointed out one further matter that's an important point both for my next example, body parts, and for my next lecture. He said that this notion of excludability that provides a hidden structure of rules which critically define the limits of property is a far more complex idea than is indicated by his lighthouse example. So in the lighthouse example, the resource may be non-excludable for essentially factual or physical contingencies. But it may also be non-excludable for purely legal or moral reasons. And this may be true of the body parts I'm going to consider next, or perhaps even of the rivers that we looked at earlier. So a source can't be classed as private property if on any of those grounds, physical, legal, or moral, it lacks the quality of excludability. And non-excludable resources lie outside the field of private property and remain in the commons. So I turn to my final example, but it's got a couple of cases in it, body parts. English law's traditional position has been starkly clear. There's no property in a corpse, and by extension, none in body parts. The principle goes back at least to Dodwood and Spence and was repeated in The Queen and Kelly. The human body, living or dead, was regarded as outside the sphere of commerce. Of course, bodies and body parts exist in the world regardless of the law, and excludability is obviously physically possible. Bodies are not like information, but the law has decided that it's not legally or morally possible, or at least not generally. Because as with so much in property law, bright lines blur in practice. Indeed, The Queen and Kelly itself carved out the now famous exception where human tissue has acquired different attributes by virtue of the application of skill, preservation, dissection, artistic preparation, then it's capable of being private property. And that principle, originally applied in relation to thefts, has since become a foothold for modern biomedical property reasoning. So once we accept that something detached from the body may in some circumstances attract proprietary character, the next question is how far can that principle stretch? You'd have to say that English law has moved incredibly cautiously. The traditional no property rule remains the baseline. And the recognised exceptions so far are pragmatic accommodations rather than grand theoretical reversals. Consider tissue samples. Legal status depends largely on purpose, so a specimen that's preserved for research may be treated as a chattel held by the research institution, but an identical sample kept for diagnostic comparisons may not be owned by anyone as a matter of private law. And then the Human Tissue Act overlays that landscape with criminal offences for unauthorised removal or use, but it leaves the civil ownership largely untouched. It controls use, not title, mirroring what we saw earlier with water and information. And I think if you are travelling with me, the idea of embryos raises sharper difficulties and organoids, which I'll talk a little bit about next week, potentially still sharper ones in this property, not property context. But what we see across these examples is a tension that runs through all modern property law. The more complex and valuable the material, the greater the temptation to use the language of property. And yet, the more closely the material connects to human identity, and this is going to touch on cultural property, the more reluctant the law becomes to do so. So our courts have therefore constructed a kind of hybrid, a measure of private right sufficient to support duties of care and stewardship, but stopping short of permitting true commodification, at least of the human body. So if we look at the examples that illustrate that, we have a couple of cases that you'll be familiar with. First of all, Yeaworth and the North Bristol NHS Trust, where a group of men undergoing chemotherapy deposited sperm with the hospital so that if their cancer treatment rendered them infertile, they might later try to have children. Through admitted negligence, the samples thawed and were lost. If the traditional no property rule in body parts applied, the men would have had no claim, no property, no bailment, no injury to their own bodies, no personal injury claim. And the Court of Appeal declined to accept that. It held that for the purposes of their negligence claim, so it was quite limited, just for that purpose, the men owned their stored sperm. And on that footing, there was both property damage and a classic bailment. The reasoning, you'd have to say, was strikingly pragmatic. The court didn't announce a general right of property in body parts. It merely used the language as an anchor for the responsibility. The response of commentators was divided. Many welcomed the decision as a humane way to supply a remedy, but critics see it as under-theorized and the instrumentality as a convenient fiction that sits uneasily with the Human Tissue Act. Others wanted to avoid the the property vocabulary altogether and instead ground liability on relational duties of care or a sui generis duty of custodianship over human material. And still others didn't want us to talk about normalizing proprietary thinking in relation to the human body at all. But the way, what the English court did is not the only way to address these issues. A similar claim reached the Scottish courts in Holditch and Lothian Hospital Health Board. It was exactly the same sort of facts as in Yeoworth. And Lord Stewart treated Yeoworth as persuasive on the property possibilities, but he refused to commit to a single conceptual route, and he allowed the case to go to proof on three possible bases, and we could learn something from them. The first one was that negligent damage to something capable of being owned, like Yeoworth, was one possibility. But the second was negligent interference with bodily integrity, i.e. harm to the person, notwithstanding that the sperm was separate from the men who were complaining. And thirdly, a developing notion of loss of autonomy. The message is subtle, I suppose, but important. The contrast with Yeoworth reveals just how contingent our solutions to these problems are. What counts as property seems to depend as much on our social and moral instincts as on legal logic. I'm going to miss out the next case, so we have time for questions. But as the science advances, I think these tensions are only going to get deeper and deeper. For example, brain organoids are three, so they're self-organizing 3D models derived from human stem cells, and they're capable of mimicking aspects of brain structure and function. So if you talk to the scientists, you know, talking about building people is becoming a real thing. So we've got perfect examples, I suppose, of objects that exist in the real world, are highly excludable, at least physically, economically significant, but morally really tightly entangled with the person. And I guess that's exactly the context where I'm hoping my three-dimensional view of property, with its focus on rights and duties, and with an eye to the social purpose, might be needed to do its work. That's for next week. So to my conclusions, I want to end this lecture much as I ended the one in Edinburgh, replacing the key question, of course. And I don't do that out of laziness, but really to reinforce the consistency of the themes which emerge. So we began tonight with a simple question, what do we own and what can we own? And I was trying to persuade you that the answer is anything but simple. From all the examples we've considered, Picasso paintings, wild fish, rivers, information, horse racing, spectacles, body parts, it seems that one truth emerges. Different assets are subject to different answers as to who owns what and precisely how. Moreover, the reasons for the differences are rarely articulated but seem to me to be profoundly important. The nature of the asset, the interests asserted, the nature of the protection demanded, all seem to shape the outcome. That means we can't treat the word property as a magic label that automatically delivers a secure package of rights of enjoyment, exclusivity, or value. Nor can we assume that the rules which work for paintings on walls or for wild fish will also work for body parts or personal data or digital assets. I suppose we do have one lodestar. An asset can't be property unless it's possible for someone to have an exclusive right to the use and enjoyment of it. Although, as I said earlier, even that's invariably limited by the law. But as we've also seen tonight, that quality, that excludability, rivalrousness, is assessed not only by the practical question of control, but also by social and moral concerns over whether the law should permit such private control. In short, property is not a value-neutral category. It embodies a decision about what we value and about how power over those valuable resources is allocated and restrained. That decision demands careful justification, and increasingly, I think, it demands some change in our approach, as I hope to show in the next lecture. Thank you for coming tonight, and Miss Lee.